Edie Lambert on the Dying to Ask podcast.
This is a big deal.
It's a big deal for me. It's a big deal. I'm really honored, and thank you.
No, thank you. I was thinking today, I've reported on 5 continents. I have anchored more than, and this is a scary number, 20,000 live hours of news for KCRA. I did the math. Scary math. But there's one thing I have never done in all my years here.
Me neither.
And that is sit here with you on any kind of a broadcast. We've never done that.
We are coworkers, but we don't actually work together because our hours are so different. I don't even usually see you.
No. I mean, when we do see each other, it's a bad thing. I've had a late day or you're having a very early day.
Or it's on the weekend with a lot of wine.
So that's, that's true, too. Yeah. So it basically took me creating a podcast, having you on as a guest, hooking up a phone for us to record a live show together. But I am very excited about this because you have come up with this concept of studying the science of happiness, which has become a really buzzworthy, interesting thing that so many people are interested in. So that's what we're going to talk about today, is what
and
you found
so
out.
So much of this research is coming out of Northern California, Sacramento, Davis, Berkeley, Stanford. So a lot, we are ground zero for a lot of what's happening.
Like a hotbed of happiness.
We really are.
Or lack thereof.
At least a study of it.
Yeah. All right. So on this Dying to Ask, what is the science of happiness? How technology is looking into our brains for the root causes of our happiness, or maybe the lack thereof. Mm-hmm. And then some of the simple techniques on how to be a happier person. And then I want to know the impact all this happy talk has had on you. Because I know that working on a 5-part series can make you downright miserable. Even if it's about happiness.
Yeah, ask Brandon, who's had to edit a whole series that has very few visuals.
So we're talking happiness with Edie Lambert on This Dying to Ask.
I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast.
If I asked you how you were doing today, like if I said, how are you? You likely would not answer happy.
I usually say I'm doing well.
Doing well, which is grammatically correct. We appreciate that. But it's interesting, like if I asked a 4-year-old, if I asked your daughter, I'm happy.
Right.
Like kids always answer it like that. I wonder why we don't.
You know, there's a lot of ways to answer that. And actually, looking at the science of happiness, I think that it would be better called the science of well-being. Because we're not happy all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the truth. And I think our expectation of happy is like that moment we take a bite of cake, or the moment we learn that we got a job, or, you know, these big things, the bar set high of what constitutes happiness. Whereas a lot of this is really geared toward well-being, so that even through times that you're not necessarily happy, you're in a place where you have kind of that deep reservoir of a feeling of well-being. You're more resilient. You can bounce back from things. You're less reactive. So if you are in traffic, you're less likely to be yelling at the car in front of you or to slam on, you know, your horn.
Right.
Greater sense of well-being, I think, is more accurate.
So when did you come up with the idea that you wanted to study happiness? Do you remember that?
I kept reading in the New York Times and national magazines and just over and over. I'm interested in these articles, and I kept seeing researchers out of UC Berkeley, UC Davis, Stanford, UC San Francisco. I just kept seeing all these Northern California researchers quoted in these articles, or the article was centered on a book that they had published, or work that they were doing, a study they had just released. And every single time I would think, we should be doing something on this. But, you know, that never happens. And so that got me thinking, there is so much there. This would be a great 5-part series.
Yeah. Was it hard, not to throw anybody under the bus, but you're kind of our political guru here. Was that a hard thing for you to go in and pitch to people saying, I want to study the science of happiness?
I actually pitched it for a while. And it was kind of like, oh, yeah, you know. Hmm. And our new news director loved it. So, I mean, I didn't need to ask him twice.
That's great.
He thought it was great.
Good. So where did you start off by studying happiness? Because if you just put the word happiness mm-hmm. in and you do a news search, it is interesting how much comes up on it. Everything from corporate workplaces to raising your children. I mean, mm-hmm. people want to know how to be happy. Does that imply that we're all unhappy or that we're just suddenly focusing on it?
I think maybe that for all of us, there's a sense that maybe we could be doing a little better than we are. Even for people who feel generally happy, you know, there's times that maybe you do yell at your kids or you don't handle something as well as you could have, and you think, how can I kind of walk this back and do better?
And so when you started looking into it, what did you start finding?
I guess part of it was I've been tucking this away for quite some time. So at UC Davis, there was a gratitude lab run by Dr. Emmons, who's now retired. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to include him. But I was aware of that lab. And so various parts of this I've been tucking away over time. And so I just kind of went into where I've been putting those notes and started right there.
Did you have to figure out what the definition of happiness was?
Yes.
To start off with? Because I think it means such different things to different people. So how do these guys define happiness?
I think as a general sense of well-being. And so if you think about that bite of cake, which is like, oh, yum, makes you happy but you can't have 5,000 pieces of cake.
Not
or
often.
If you can, you shouldn't.
Right, right.
And that's definitely going to make you unhappy. And so So it is more of the things that you can do to feel a greater sense of connection to yourself and those around you. I mean, that is proven that the more we feel connected to loved ones in our community, the greater sense of well-being we have, the more people report feeling happy.
When did people start studying happiness? Because, you know, it's funny, I grew up in a culturally very different household where my parents are from Ireland, and I remember my father saying, when I said I wanted to go into doing what we do, like, he didn't really consider it a real job, to be quite fair. He really didn't. And I said, well, I just really want to be happy. And that was just such a foreign concept to him. He's like, well, you don't go to work to be happy.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was just a different kind of time. And now a lot of people do go to work to be happy. So when did we as a society start caring about well-being and happiness and start studying it on that level?
I think some of the roots of this probably go back to the 60s and 70s, frankly, but technology has changed things. So scientists can look at the brain and see exactly what's going on in the brain. And so that's why this is focused on the science of happiness. And some of these tips, people will watch and think, well, obviously, I know that. We already knew that. But we didn't really know why or necessarily how. Let me give you one great example. I thought this was just fascinating. This was out of Sac State. This was out of the business school, not even out of the psych department. They know that loneliness is a profound problem in workplaces. Up to 40% of people report feeling lonely in the workplace, and it depletes productivity. That's where it comes into the business school. It is such a problem that Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain, has appointed a minister of loneliness.
Really?
To deal solely with this issue. Okay, so the research.
Oh, hold on, one second. Why do they feel lonely?
A lack of a sense of connection. And it's a great question, because you can be alone and not lonely at all. I love being alone. You know me, I'm an introvert.
We both are. Oddly enough, as we talk to all your fans. But like, why do people, I mean, we live in these and we work in these very open concept environments, and people are nonstop chatting on social media to connect with colleagues who can be around the world. Why do they feel lonely?
That I don't know that I can necessarily answer. I just know that people are reporting feeling lonely. I think to some degree social media is its own weird thing that keeps you from, like, I can Facebook like something of yours, but if I'm not sitting and talking to you, it's a very different experience.
Okay.
So they put people through an MRI, and they showed them neutral faces, so faces that are designed to be no emotion unless you're told something. And one group of faces, people were told, this is a social person, the characteristics that go with that, and parts of the brain just lit up. They showed the next set of faces and describe these people with traits that are associated with loneliness, and it was a flat line.
Huh.
They didn't even register. So if you are someone who is feeling lonely and disconnected at work, if you're not even necessarily registering with the people around you, the takeaway, I mean, on one hand, it could be, well, that's pretty depressing. But on the other hand, then you're going to have to work a little harder at it. What they also know about loneliness is that the more lonely people seem to feel, the more they are stuck in their own heads. Mm-hmm. They're very self-centered. And so it can be as simple as walking up to a co-anchor and saying, how are you? It's making a connection and it's drawing something out of the other person.
It's
not, this is about me, or do you like me, or you walked by me in the hall and you didn't say hi, and a lonely person might assume, well, she hates me, and someone who has a better sense of well-being might think, oh, Deirdre's distracted today. Same action, different way of viewing it.
Right.
So from this research, they're looking at kind of ways to systematically help integrate people who are lonely. But like, for instance, you wouldn't do a forced company picnic for someone who felt lonely. That's just going to make it 10 times worse. It needs to be those one-on-one interactions. And they're responsible for some of this.
Did the researchers indicate if people are wired one way or another?
Yeah, and that is true. But even with that, we can rewire our brains to some degree, which is pretty exciting.
That is interesting. And so I guess, say, you mentioned that this was research that was coming out of the business school. Businesses care because...
happy people are productive people.
Ding, ding, ding.
Bottom line.
So that's why you see so much in the headlines about CEOs who are embarking on these happiness journeys, trying to spread this.
And UC Davis Health has a chief wellness officer whose sole job is to look at the well-being of the employees in the UC Davis Health system. So he's looking at their happiness and what can be designed from a corporate structure to support that.
Hmm. And what have they been able to figure out so far?
Well, one of the things I loved was that he... it's not his research, but he's taking all this research and applying it to what they do there. Busy work makes people crazy, right?
Get out of town. Really?
Right. So we know that, but then the question is, well, what are you going to do about it? So if you have a chief wellness officer, now they can all of a sudden come in and figure out, what is it that is taking up a lot of time for our doctors, for instance, that they hate a lot of that paperwork? Can we make it more efficient? Can we streamline this? Can we give some of this to other people who might be in a better position to focus more on the paperwork? Our doctors can focus on helping people, which is their sense of purpose mm-hmm. in their work. And letting busy work pile up is proven to create a lot of stress and burnout and just make people hate their jobs. So if for the work that you can delegate or streamline, great, do that. For the work that you can't, he suggests just do it. Don't put it off. Don't not think about it. Think about it, organize it, because if you let it pile up, it really will lower your level of happiness at work.
Did they go into it all what it was like when the workplace started talking to people about happiness? Because I could see that feeling a little obtrusive, like snoopy to some employees, or were they on board with it because they got the bigger picture?
That I don't know. It'd be a great question for the Sac State business professor, because he is focused on businesses here in town and gone in and asked people questions.
I just feel like if you or I were asked at work, like, are you happy? I would interpret
like,
a lot.
Who are you going to say?
What do you mean? Of course I'm happy. Never been
all
happier.
All the time.
Right.
Yes.
It's really interesting. Okay, let's take a quick break. How's this going for you so far?
Great.
Oh, good.
Just get to show up and answer questions.
Natural podcast. I like it. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, there's a lot of money in happiness. There's a lot of monetization going on. I want to talk a little bit about that. And then I want to talk about some of the tips, tricks, things you learn along the way where we can all inject a little more happiness into our day. We'll be back with more Dying to Ask right after this. 22 what? As we record this, that's how many Democrats are in the race now to unseat the Republican president, Donald Trump, as president. 22!
Wow.
Our Hearst Television Commitment 2020 coverage extends to the podcast world this year with WMUR-TV's The Trail. Host Adam Sexton interviews all the big names as they make their way through the battleground that is New Hampshire. Check out The Trail wherever you get your podcasts. I coach middle school track, and a couple of weeks ago, my eighth grade boys, who can be easily distracted for many reasons, had gathered during practice by one of the fences where the preschool and TK kids were kind of corralled in and they were playing. And so I see all these boys go over, and they're hovering over these little kids. I'm like, guys, come on. And they completely blew me off. So I go a little bit closer and I look, and they're in the sweetest way possible interacting with these little kids who were trying to catch a ladybug.
Oh.
And, you know, these eighth grade boys who can be this, you know, bundle of hormones were so drawn to the joy of the little kids looking at the ladybug. I just, it took my breath away. because there was such, like, as you talk about happiness, like, there was, it was such a true, joyful, happy moment. And I remember thinking, gosh, like, when we seem to be born with that, but then it kind of, as you get older, I don't know if it's just, you know, the world and negativity starts to creep in, mm-hmm. or we start to see the world differently. But I thought, gosh, what a great moment to bottle up. Like, can't we all just find that happiness, that joy in a single, small, solitary thing?
And what you're describing is actually being studied under the overall umbrella of awe, A-W-E.
Oh.
And the more we can put ourselves in places where, you know, you are out in nature in that sense of awe, or even in your own garden and, you know, seeing a ladybug, or, you know, for me with a five-year-old, we're catching ladybugs all day long, and it is. I think a lot of these things that are being studied, as I've sort of looked at them as a whole, the more you can get out of your own thoughts, the happier you're going to be. That mm-hmm. seems to be a real common thread between gratitude and self-compassion and all of these things. Just focusing outward mm-hmm. is very powerful.
And focusing on very small, little, minute things.
Can be small or big.
Very tough, I think, to do these days, because the world feels, to me, very loud. You know, I mean, I walk around with two phones. I have four or five different Facebook pages I'm posting on. There's Instagram, there's Twitter. There are a lot of places where you have a voice, but there aren't a lot of places where you have silence anymore.
And I think these scientists would tell you you've got to schedule that in, or you've got to schedule some technology out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There's some science behind that.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the techniques that you learned, because that is one of the things that comes up in this five-part series. And you mentioned scheduling and silence. Meditation has not a new thing, but it has definitely changed in the last few years to try to make it more accessible to people.
It's true. And I think what's also changed is what scientists have been able to link to meditation. I'm not going to use the word prove, and we'll talk about that later. But there have been studies, Dr. Oz talks about this, of psoriasis and some of these other skin conditions that can be really hard to treat, or you use pretty harsh medications that can be controlled with meditation. They have looked at brain scans of people who meditate and found changes in the brain, a thickening in the area, a part of the brain that lends itself, that is the part that processes altruism, for instance. So physically changing the brain through this. And so again, that's I think what's new is the level of things that we're finding out about why it works and how it works. And some of it's still a mystery, which is what makes it a lot of fun. Yeah. One of the things that surprised me for meditation is that you don't have to sit, you know, cross-legged mm-hmm. for 30 minutes. You can really just, when you find yourself getting stressed, just look out a window and just to take yourself out of your own thoughts and just look out a window and just try to observe for 30 seconds, for a minute, whatever you have. In fact, we talked about the wellness officer at UC Davis Health. Doctors get into profoundly stressful situations. So they might have lost a patient or had to give bad news or had a family screaming at them or a patient screaming at them. And then they've got to walk into the next patient literally 2 minutes later. They've got to reset. So this is with no time at all. And so this is a technique that he teaches his doctors and nurses and other health professionals to be able to reset, just to go from these profoundly stressful situations into the very next person. That in 1 or 2 minutes, if you just, for him, mm-hmm. he has a picture in his office that's a castle, and he will sit at his desk and he'll look across the room and he'll count how many windows, how many he'll just go over through and just count and make his mind just focus only on that. And then he's ready for the next
That's
patient.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Did you look at meditation apps?
I did, yeah. I think that they can be extremely helpful. And again, to have somebody to kind of walk you through a guided meditation, I think rather than just quiet and stillness, that can be very helpful to keep you focused. You can focus on what they're telling you to focus
yeah.
on.
I've used one for the last year and a half, 2 years, called Headspace, which I call it the rock and roll app. You know, everybody from Bono to whomever.
Yeah, that is a highly regarded app.
Super popular. But what's nice
And science-based.
And science-based. What's nice about it is that it talks you through in kind of a really soothing way. But what's really great about it is that you can do meditation, like you said, from 1 minute to an hour.
Yeah.
I've never made it to an hour. Huh. 10 minutes is my max, but 10 is a good reset. But what it has done is it's forced me to sit still.
Yeah.
And it's forced me to be quiet, which is not, I'm not a very quiet person. You might have noticed that. But it has forced me just to take a breath and to be able to like tune everything out and listen to very small noises. You know, like I do this sometimes with the kids I'd mentioned I coach.
Yeah.
I usually do, you know, the 1 day of like meditation stuff with them because all athletes now do this.
Yes.
Every Olympic athlete I know does meditation.
Yeah.
Every single one I've ever covered has learned how to focus their mind because you have mere seconds to do, you know, something they might have trained 20 years for that they compete for 90 seconds. You don't want to mess it up. So they've all learned how to like center their mind, some better than others, obviously. But learning to tune into a sound rather than tuning out everything else is a really powerful thing.
Mm-hmm. So that's something, I mean, all the tips in my series are really things that are free. Mm-hmm. You can do them at home. You can do them right now. You can just try them starting whenever. And, it, you know, I think the more discipline you have, like anything.
Right.
If you want to run a marathon, you know, you...
You should go running once in a while.
You go running once in a while.
You want to do that? Is that on your happiness list now?
Running?
A marathon?
That would make my husband very happy. He's a big marathoner. Let me talk you through another one. I just love this one. So gratitude seems to come up over and over and over, just in a million different ways as a basis for feeling better. And again, I think it's because it pulls you out of yourself and thinking about what someone else has done or thinking about the things around you that you are grateful for. It just pulls you out of your own mental, you know, negative rut. So a common practice, this has been around forever, is, you know, writing three things that you're grateful for, and they have measured that this works, and they have measured that you're rewiring your brain when you do that. When that becomes a habit, just the same way as when you drive home for the first time after you've moved, you have to think about it.
Yes.
If you've practiced gratitude for long, you don't even think about it anymore. It's a different way of approaching the world. You've trained your brain to do that.
I also do this in the morning. I do a lot of stuff before I leave the house in the middle of the night. But I do. And they're never big things.
Yeah.
The first one is always coffee. Every single time.
Cheers, sister. Yeah, I know it's on my list.
But it is funny. It does just make you feel a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. So here's another one. To make it a point of saying thank you more often. And if you want to be a real PhD about this, there are three parts to a really good thank you.
Walk me
that's
through
right.
this.
Okay.
Okay.
So, and I will, and it's going to sound like, wow, that's a whole hullabaloo. And I'm going to tell you because they have timed it out and scientifically gotten an average for what this should take, an average length of time. But the first step is to thank somebody for whatever the action is. The second step is to acknowledge whatever part they played. And the third part is the impact it had on you.
Oh.
So this might look like, Deirdre, thank you for holding the door open for me. I know you're really busy, but with my arms full, I really couldn't have managed without you. Okay, that probably took 7 seconds.
That was fantastic.
Right? And so the benefit is, of course, when you are feeling thankful and you're noticing things to thank people for, that just makes you feel better. But if you have been really acknowledged for something you did, that makes you feel better too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you know what's interesting? That also counteracts what you were talking about earlier about the loneliness because you've done the engagement with somebody.
Totally.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, what's another one?
So they studied the length of time this would take, even though it sounds like three steps, good Lord. 12 seconds would be an average for a really great thank you.
Huh. I love this.
Yeah.
So simple.
So
this,
simple.
This sounds a lot to me like, like when you write somebody a handwritten, you and I write cards to each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Some very inappropriate, but we do write each other a lot of cards. And I get the biggest kick out of seeing a card on my desk that you left from the night before and reading it. Is that also one of those techniques to feeling happy?
Absolutely, because it's a connectedness. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of our happiness at home, at work, in our society is that sense of connection. And, you know, something that is, I didn't have a chance to put it, like when you put together TV stories, it's often like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And it's partly the interviews that you got and the information that you have and the visuals you have. And sometimes it's just a piece that you just can't figure out where to put in. Altruism.
That's why you come to the podcast.
Right.
We have all this time here.
So altruism, I wasn't able to work in, but there have been lots of studies now showing that if you give everyone in a group $20 and you say you can spend this on yourself or you can spend this on someone else, that $20 will buy you a much greater amount of happiness if you have done something for someone else with that money. Hmm. And the most recent study looked at people who are incarcerated. And they were able to contribute to organizations that help children, for instance. And so they worked to earn the money, and they were given the option to do that. And that alone is going to make people feel a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And then what to do with that money. And those who did reach outside of themselves and come from an altruistic place came away from that study feeling happier.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
All of these things you're talking about, for the most part, are free.
It's true. And going back to that, so you think, okay, well, that's great. Well, actually, it is great because now you can maybe try a program in a prison that will lend itself to really helping people figure things out and get back on the right track once they're out. So there are really practical reasons for studying this population of people with certain things,
right.
what might work.
Were you surprised by how much happiness has been monetized as you did your research? Because you can buy courses, you can buy,
yeah.
you know, 10 ways to happiness. Like all the stuff you've mentioned so far is free.
Yes.
And we can all do it the second after you review and rate and subscribe this podcast. But there are a lot of people making a lot of money off of happiness. Did that surprise you?
There are also a lot of crazy claims.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad you brought it up because I think it should be buyer beware. I talked to a global expert in meditation who's based out of UC Davis who just said so many of the headlines are junk science.
It sounds like snake oil, a lot of it.
And he says it really is. He never uses the word science of happiness. Never, ever. I mean, for him, it's about well-being. But yeah, meditation, apps, workshops, books, blah, 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 retreats is a $1 billion industry a year just in the U.S. That's not even looking at Europe and all the other places. So, I would be cautious with some of the claims. For instance, that you can change your chromosomes through meditation. Well, maybe, but I don't think that's proven.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I know you like to prove things, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about the science of happiness and how scientific it really is. What a lot of people might not know is that you come from a very scientific family.
Right.
You're kind of the anomaly in your family,
That's
actually.
True. I'm the black sheep.
Yeah, although listening to you talk today, maybe not so much. All right, we'll be back with Edie Lambert right after this. Review of the week comes from A. Bloom, who says, enjoyed listening on a long commute. I love that.
That's a long commute.
It is. And that's how I listen to podcasts too. Sometimes I don't live that far away. Sometimes I take the long way home just so I can keep listening to a show.
Yeah.
Sometimes I sit in the driveway and I finish it. Super fun like that. Thanks for the iTunes review, A. Bloom, and keep them coming. One of the things people might not know about you is you're actually the daughter of two scientists.
That's right.
And
two marine biologists.
Your sister is a scientist as well.
Right. And she studies cancer.
Yeah. And so you are not a scientist. You are playing one on TV, I guess, this week for this
Right. That's my version.
Yeah. So I wondered, you know, just having grown up in that kind of a household, how you approach studying the science of happiness.
So compared to, you know, the labs that I literally grew up in, this is different. You know, some of these studies, there aren't even control groups. And for a lot of these things, there are so many variables that go into how we feel. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could come down to, did you eat breakfast, right?
Right.
And the person sitting next to you, did you have a death in your family? I mean, the things that factor into some of the science of happiness are a little squishy scientifically. So,
is it a scientific term you grew up with, squishy?
No, but no. I think my mother would understand exactly what I'm saying. And would agree. And so I was pretty careful in my writing of this series. I never use the word prove. So I say, you know, studies suggest that this is working for some people. And, you know, there's a difference between correlation. So this is happening at the same time this is happening. We see these correlations and causation, mm-hmm. where we know for sure that meditation will, you know, save the world or whatever they're proving. And so, a lot of these researchers, they're the first ones to say that. They will say, we have not proven this. We've shown a correlation between these two things. It is likely that if you do this, we have shown from our group that this seems to work for a lot of people. The other thing that I would also caution with some of the claims, and you know, you look at the meditation claims that this can beat depression, I would sure hate for people to not see a doctor if they are feeling depressed. I think meditation could maybe be one of many tools that they
maybe
have in their tool belt.
Maybe a starting point for a lot of people.
Sure, or in conjunction with therapy and medication. So it just depends on the case. But yeah. I think that they're showing a lot of correlations. I think that from even these MRIs, it's very interesting what they're showing, but I don't know that you can always say that things are proven.
Mm-hmm. What would you say would be like a good starting point for somebody who really wants to up their happiness quotient, their own personal happiness? Where would you begin?
Somebody
who wants to like really look at their own life and say, can I enjoy life a little bit more?
Yeah. I will tell you that from the second I interviewed Emiliana at the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, which is an entire center devoted to the science of happiness, and their whole goal is to make these studies accessible for people. So if they know that something is tended to work for people in a study, they'll put it on their website in a way that you and I can digest it and put it into practice.
Let me back up just for a second. You walk into that center. Like, is it happy in that place?
It was pretty happy. And you know what? It's just like this, they've got like two or three offices in the back of a childcare center off campus because UC Berkeley is so impacted.
Right.
There was no space for anything. So there are several blocks from campus. But yes, I did feel like it's people who have a good sense of well-being.
Yeah, kind of choose that, I suppose.
Yes.
All right, so back to.
So Emiliana, I had asked her, you know, kind of where to start, and she suggested just with a deep breath. And, okay, you get it. Mom's told you take a deep breath, but in terms of what scientifically it does for your body, you cannot not have an impact on your body when you take a deep breath and then exhale a little more slowly than you inhaled. That physically calms your body down. There is no way. It's like if you put your hand under water, your hands get wet. If you take a deep breath in this manner and breathe out more slowly than you breathed in, your physiology will calm down.
No matter what.
No matter what. So I found myself doing a lot of that, trying to pull off a 5-part series under deadline and, you know, having to come in early and stay late to get all this done. There was a lot of deep breathing, and it helps. It really does help. another one that I really love is a whole area of research on what's called self-compassion, which sounds like letting yourself off the hook and letting yourself be lazy about any given thing. It is just the opposite. It is being kinder to yourself, but also taking responsibility.
So for example,
you feel like you just blew an interview and you walk away from that and you're like, God, I'm such an idiot. I am such an idiot, which would be, for me, kind of a common reaction. So instead of doing that, to kind of flip it and think, how would you talk to a friend about this? Now, if you came away from an interview saying that you weren't really feeling that great about it, I'd say, oh my, Deirdre, you're one of the smartest people I know. If that didn't go well, this is probably not the job for you. There's probably a reason that there wasn't a connection. And also, you never know. You may have come across better than you thought. I mean, those are things I would say to you, but I would never say them
to
myself.
But you wouldn't say it to yourself.
So that's a good first step.
It's an easy one, too.
It is, yeah.
What about just the negative talk that people do that also tends to lead to them feeling unhappy? Why do we do that? Because you just did it there as you were kind of role-playing with yourself.
Right. So there, Allison, I believe it's Ledbetter, out of, I think I'm getting her last name wrong on this, but she's a scientist at UC Davis, has studied this. Actually, she did a TED Talk that has 4 million views.
Wow.
So clearly this is resonating for
yes.
people. And she studies why we get focused on the negative. And her research is fascinating. Let me give you an example. Taking two groups of people, and with one group saying, there is a new surgery that doctors are just, you know, taking to market with a 70% success rate. They're using robots to do this type of surgery. What do you think? Love it. Next group. There's this new surgery, blah, blah, with a 30% failure rate. 30% of the people are dying. Blah, hate it. Okay, so they already knew that's just how it goes. I mean, marketing 101, right? How you spin the same number. But they then went back, and the group that they had given 70%, they went back and said, but you also need to know that 30% of the people who go through this procedure are dying. What do you think? Everybody hated the surgery. They went to the 30% group and said, 70% of the people who've gone through the surgery have had fantastic results. What do you think? Still no. Stuck in the negative. They have given people math problems that are pretty simple, but they're phrased in the positive and the negative. When they're framed taking a positive to a negative, people can do that math like that. Using the same numbers, if you're converting negative to positive, it takes almost twice as long.
Huh.
Our brain is just harder for our brains to think that way, to go from negative to positive. And her takeaway is, okay, you have to work at it.
You have to work at it.
You have to
work at being positive.
That's right.
You have to choose positivity.
That's right. And so it is, when you find yourself in that place, practicing gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
It may be as you're driving home and you've had a crummy day, to just make yourself stop focusing on that for 5 minutes and think, okay, well, what went right today?
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get home, you will feel better.
You will.
And you'll walk in the door. I mean, you take that and now you've walked in the door with something either positive or negative. Now it's affecting your home life positively or negatively.
Yeah. What did you find out about workplace? Because I think this is going to be the one that people really tune into in this series. And I think you're saving it for the end. But what did you find out about happiness in the workplace?
There were actually some logistical reasons that we put that one last that I won't bore people with. But just logistically, it worked better there.
What were the big takeaways for you on that?
So we looked at the loneliness, and which we talked about, and we looked at the busy work. But some of the other things are, to what degree are we productive in the hours that we put in? And you're pretty productive at 40 hours, and you can continue your productivity up to 55 hours, and that's it. And any more time that you're spending at work could be better spent sleeping or exercising or pretty much anything else.
Interesting.
And the way she worded it is basically at that point, you are wasting everyone's time. You're wasting everyone's time. So if you want to boost your own happiness, you are better off leaving work and going for a walk. And the other thing too, which is just everybody knows this, when you get away from work or whatever, you know, the ideas come to you when you're in the shower, on a walk, or for you running, I'm sure.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. I know we need to wrap up, but how did working on this and studying the science of happiness impact your happiness? Did it change the way you look at things?
It has. It's been really joyful.
You have such a smile on your face.
Yeah, it's been really
great.
Fun. And it's also been fun I think we talked about this a little bit, but normally when people at work say, oh, what are you working on? And it's like, oh, politics. It's like, okay, bye.
See ya.
Please don't talk to me about that. But, you know, even just at work, you know, sharing all this with people, people are so interested and they want the information, which as a journalist, you know, that makes me joyful. I'm excited to be putting this out there for our viewers and sharing this research. And the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley offers an 8-week free online course of the walking you through the science of happiness, which I haven't had time to do because I've been working on this, but I plan to sign up this week and my husband's going to sign up too. And we're just going to do it together and just walk through all these practices. And again, it is free. It's just out there. Yale has the same thing. And maybe when we're done with the one from Berkeley, we'll sign up for the one at Yale and just compare them. And I'm sure they're different and just try it out. So, yeah, it's been very light compared to my typical work.
What's your big takeaways, as we do wrap up, I promise, what's your big takeaway and maybe your challenge to the people who have listened to this today?
That these things are simple, but it doesn't mean they're easy. So they take discipline and practice and repetition, and I go back to discipline. So it's almost like dieting. I mean, we all know eat less and work out, but dieting is really hard.
Right.
And some of these things are difficult. They're very simple, but having the discipline to do them every day until they really become a habit is not easy.
Yeah.
And so that's why I included the research, like getting stuck on negativity. So why would you want to know that for a happiness series? Well, because if you want to be happier, you actually have to do the work.
And so what is happiness for you?
For me, I do think that it is a walking through life with more grace. And when the bad things happen, to be able to weather them more gracefully, to not be so reactive, to be able to, you know, remember and honor that the people around us are, they're doing the best they can as well. And
you never know what someone's going through.
It's really true.
Yeah.
It's really true. And so, yeah, and I feel like I've already felt a greater sense of peace. I don't necessarily think it's feeling happy all the time, and I think that's a disastrous goal.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more we think we should be happy all the time, the less happy we're going to be, and that's actually proven. But yes, a greater sense of well-being and a greater sense of connection and kindness.
Well, it's made me happy to do a podcast with Edie Lambert to get to work with you finally.
Thank you.
Directly, you know,
yeah,
in the same room.
At the same time.
recorded on an iPhone, I might point out. All good. Edie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've really enjoyed learning about this through you.
Thank you for the opportunity. I know you have a lot of guests you could include, but it made me so happy to be able to share this information with the platform that you provide through your podcast.
11 and a half seconds. I was timing it in my head. Thanks, Edie Lambert. No surprise, there are lots of podcasts out there about happiness. You could try listening to Happier by Gretchen Rubin. It has 70 million downloads, which is a few more than Dying to Ask. So far, anyway. And a relatively new one out there that I have totally fallen in love with is called Before Breakfast. It's hosted by Laura Vanderkam. She's a time management specialist, and she's the author of books like the New York Times bestseller, What the Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast. Before Breakfast is a daily 5 to 7 minute show to increase your productivity, which in turn makes a lot of us happier. Lots of Laura's suggestions will sound familiar because they also showed up in Edie's research, and we talked about them on this podcast. It would make me crazy happy if you would review and rate Dying to Ask. It's kind of like a podcast report card, so screenshot what you wrote, and then I'll put it up in my Instagram stories at RunReadSip. Follow Edie Lambert on Facebook at KCRAEdie and on Instagram at Edie.Lambert. Producer Jeff is back next week. Thanks for checking out Dying to Ask.